the letter of James. Okay, let's go ahead and pray. Lord, I do ask you to help us to understand your words. And Lord, I ask you to help us recognize that when we come to this holy book, that our sincerity will be noticed by the Spirit of God. And I do pray and ask you to help us to be faithful to this book. In Jesus' name, amen. Oh, another thing I got done was I got the at the printer, the reference Bible for the red letter edition is going to be starting. And so then I thought, before I got that all done, I thought, well, I'm going to check out the Old Testament and make Thus Saith the Lord, make that blue. And then I asked the printer about it, and he said that would be pretty pricey because all these different colors. So I did it, and I have it on a CD. So I have it on a PDF file, if anybody would like the reference Bible on a PDF file. And so I made God's words of the Lord in the Old Testament blue, and the Spirit of God, when he speaks, green, and the angel of the Lord, because sometimes that's an angel, sometimes that's the Lord, I made that orange. So went through the reference Bible. So if you'd like a copy of that on CD, let me know, I'll get that to you. Okay, James chapter 1. Remember, it says the title is a general epistle of James. So generally, it's going to be aimed at a time period of the Jews. It will be finishing up Daniel's 70 weeks, or the 70th week in particular. Okay, and so he's writing to the 12 tribes. And so sometimes people like to nose in other people's business or in other people's mail, you know, read other people's mail. Hey, this is a legitimate time where you can read somebody else's mail. It happened to be written to the Jews. Okay, some of us remember party lines. Remember party lines? You know, what was ours, Dad? Ours was the second ring? First or second? Two rings was ours, and the neighbors were like one ring, and we're on the phone talking, you can hear them breathing on the other end. Hang up the phone! Nose, anything goes. Well, we're in James, and so we're reading somebody else's mail. Okay, and we can apply some of these things, okay, but yet we need to understand the doctrine. Okay, so in verse 2, we went through that, 2, 3, and 4 last week. He says, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. Okay, when you read that and you understand the doctrine, he's speaking this to Jewish people of the tribulation who are in danger of being beheaded and sacrificed in a religious ceremony. And he says to them, count it all joy. Then he says, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience, but let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. Okay, now we remember that the word perfect in the Bible does not refer to sinlessness. It doesn't refer to that. It's not how defined. And we often don't use it that way either. Now, probably the best evidence for that is in Hebrews 5, verse 8. Where it mentions about the Lord Jesus Christ being made perfect. But yet the Bible calls him a holy child. Okay, so he's sinless from birth. Okay, but here in Hebrews 5 verse 8, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered, and being made perfect. Okay, being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation. Okay, so in that context, he completed a mission. And that's how the word is used throughout the Bible, the word perfect. Okay, now the word patience. This is an interesting study when you run through that. If you would, try Luke 21, verse 19. For the Jews of the tribulation time period, patience is a necessary part of their righteousness. Okay, so let's see, Luke 21, verse 19, he says, in your patience possess ye your souls. That's kind of an unusual statement. The implications there is that if a person loses patience, they lose their soul. But look at the context, and it will make sense. Okay, patience, that's one thing you never want to pray for, because you always get trouble in patience. Okay, so in the context of Luke 21, you'll see that he is dealing with Judea. Luke 21, verse 21, telling somebody, advising them to flee to the mountains. 22, days of vengeance. 20, Jerusalem, desolation. Okay, 24, Jerusalem is trodden down by Gentiles. Okay, you see how the Bible fits beautifully when you understand the dispensations. That's a tribulation passage. And so you keep the passages within their context. So let's look up patience some more in other places. Let's try Hebrews 6, verse 12. So in Hebrews, we're dealing with the same people, so the same individuals or recipients of the letter, the epistle of Hebrews, okay, the epistle of Paul to the Hebrews, Hebrews 6, verse 4, 5, and 6 are a real mess for Baptists to try to apply. Okay, and the charismatics use those verses to teach a born-again believer can get unborn again, and that's a real mess also. Years ago, I remember I saw Curtis Hudson had one of them little booklets. John R. Rice and Curtis Hudson had books, but then they had these little like sermon-like booklets. And he had one on Hebrews 6, 4 through 6, and I just thought, well, for kicks, I'll read that. And I thought I was reading Jehovah Witness material, running to the Greek to try to change the English. He had nothing on the dispensations, nothing on the doctrine. He was trying to make it fit into his eternal security Baptist doctrine, because he didn't. John R. Rice thought dispensations was heresy. Okay, and Hiles Anderson, they just totally ignored it. They just used the Bible for instructional or motivational preaching. Okay, and so John R. Rice and then Curtis Hudson, his follower, he had nothing on dispensation, so he could not understand Hebrews 6, 4 through 6. Okay, they knew, they knew the Pentecostals were wrong on it, but they didn't have the answer for it either. But Hebrews 6, 12, he says, that ye be not slothful, but followers of him through faith and patience inherit the promises. Okay, that's the Jewish remnant. The ones who inherit the Abrahamic promises are the ones who have faith and patience. In Hebrews 11, how often do you notice that? Hebrews 11, what do they always say about Hebrews 11? The Hall of Faith chapter, right? They always say that. But when you read it, how do they miss the works? It's all through there. Okay, by faith, verse 4. By faith, Abel offered. There's works. Verse 7, by faith, Noah being warned of God, moved with fear. If Noah had not built the ark, what would have happened to him? Okay, so you have all through there faith and works, okay, but it is a Jewish designation for Jewish people during a tribulation time period. Often, if a person doesn't know the answers for these things, all we need to do is at least recognize it's written to somebody else and it's different. Okay, Revelation 14, 12. And of course, when we go into the middle of Revelation here, around 14, okay, we know that we're dealing with the tribulation or Daniel's 70th week. And so here's what he says, Revelation 14, 12. Here is the patience of the saints. So this is the definition for patience of this time period. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So we got both of them there. Okay, and so I thank God that I'm living in this time period where we have eternal security. Okay, so back in James 1, verse 2, 3, and 4. Now for us, doctrinally, there is a similar passage written by Paul to the church in Romans chapter 5.
No, Dad. Dad says yes.
Romans 5, verse 1. Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, so there's salvation, justification, by whom also we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand. So now he's dealing with our stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. And not only so, but we glory in tribulations, plural, not the tribulation, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope, and hope maketh not ashamed. So there's safer ground for us in the church, is that Paul said he gloried in tribulations. Why? Because that leads to patience. Okay, patience like in sports. Okay, if you notice, years ago we went down to Panama as a family, and we went the rafting. Okay, not rafting, we had kayaking. Okay, and you watch the good kayakers, and when they go through the tough waters, watch them, they're smooth. They're pretty relaxed, they're hardly moving anything. But then you watch us, the inexperienced ones, when we're going through them waters, just going crazy. Okay, why? We don't have the patience. Okay, if you watch, I like watching somebody that's good on skateboards. Out in Australia, there's a place where they do that. And man, to watch somebody good, watch somebody good's fun, watch somebody bad's fun. It's got to be painful though. But to watch somebody who's so smooth on that, you watch them, they're very graceful. Why? It's because they've had a lot of tribulations. We watched one down in Costa Rica where he had tribulations for a good hour and a half. Remember that guy, Jen? Where he was running along the basketball court or soccer court. They had both of them. And then he'd come around, he was trying to jump on the highway. And man, that guy never got that thing right. And I bet you he did that probably over 100 times. And he'd come up and he'd go like this with his hands. He was learning tribulation. Okay? But if you watch somebody in a good athlete, okay, you'll see that they are under control. Okay? They pretty much are, they don't look like they're moving fast, but they're moving. They're just being very precise in their moves. Okay? And they're very relaxed in it. Why is that? Because they've already gone through tribulations, they've gone through the patience, and then the experience. Okay? The experience is, okay, we're down by one, we got 5 seconds left, and the inexperienced runner, what are we going to do, coach? What are we going to do? We got to do this. And then he gets the ball, takes one dribble, and shoots about a 70-foot shot. Like, that's helpful, and then the clock goes ding, and the other team gets the ball after 2 seconds. No, from the free throw line on the opposing end, you got 5 seconds to run clear to the dribble, clear to the other end, and take a shot. And you still got a second left on the shot. If you got a dribble around the guy, you got about half a second of a shot. But that's all that it takes to get from one end to about a 15-foot shot. Why? How do I know? I've done that. Timed it, practiced it. Okay, very. And the thing is you don't have to just go bizarre or berserk on these things. What gives that experience is the tribulation. The tribulation goes to experience or patience, and the patience goes to experience, and the experience goes to hope. Okay, now the guy that was probably one of the best trash talkers in the NBA was a white guy, a hick from French Lick. Larry Bird, they said, was the biggest trash talker. And I mean, he told McDaniels, a guy at McDaniels, they had I think 6 seconds on the clock, and they had a timeout. And he told this guy, he said, "You know, I'm getting the ball." He said, "I'm going to shoot it right here in your face." And the guy says, "Yeah, I know, and I'm going to be ready." Well, they threw the ball to Bird. He made 2 dribbles, shot it right in the guy's face, made it, and the guy says, "Man." And Bird said, "I didn't mean to leave 2 seconds on the clock." I mean, get on YouTube and type in Bird and trash talk. I mean, that guy, and then he'd razz the coaches. "You got anybody over there that can," he said to one coach, "You got anybody over there that can guard me?" He coach looked at his bench. He said, "No, I don't." Why? He had gone through tribulation, patience, and experience, and he was so confident in himself. One time he made the last shot, and right before he shot it, Casey Jones called a timeout. And he made the 3-point shot. They would have won the game, but the coach called the timeout. Had to cancel it, cancel the thing. Came to the bench, Casey Jones was drawing a play, and he just kind of, Bird just quietly said, "Coach, just tell him, give me the ball, get out of the way." He said, "Oh, okay, that sounds like a good plan." So they threw the ball, same shot, same place, boom, bucket in, they leave. I mean, why? He had gone through tribulation, patience, experience, and he was so confident. One game, he couldn't hit the broadside of a barn, but it got to the end of the game. And again, his last second shot, and he again just said to the coach, he said, "Just give me the ball, have everybody get out of the way." He said, "I'm going to run in the locker room right after I make this, and we're done." And when he shot the ball, he took off to the locker room, the ball went in, and they won the game. Okay, why is that? Because he had confidence, because he had already gone through and experienced tribulation and patience and experience and hope. Okay, and the same applies in our Christian life. Okay, the first time you go through a tribulation, you're not going to go with straight A's. The second time, the third time, the fourth time, you're not going to, you're going to have your tough times. But the time you get about, 5 or 6 of them, you should be getting a better grade. "Oh, I've been through this before. Okay, now I know how this works out." Okay, and that's, a lot of times as adults, we see a little child who's, trying to ride a bicycle or whatever, and then they're going ballistic, and we're like, "Relax, you'll get it, you'll get it." But it's a big deal to them at that time. Just as ours was a big deal to us at that time. Okay? And so a lot of times, we tend to not have patience with people because of their trials. But you got to remember, how'd you do the first time you went through it? Okay? And so that Paul writes it in this fashion for us. Okay? And so we can, if we're going to take one of the two passages, we take Romans. But then we can still learn from James. So he says in James 1 verse 5, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him." Okay, so this is asking for prayer. Now this idea of asking for wisdom, Solomon gave a great example in the Old Testament. When he became king, he asked God for discernment, is what he asked for. And God said, "You've asked a good request." He said, "You could have asked for the life of your enemies. You could have asked for wealth. But since you asked for that," he said, "then I'm going to give you wisdom and understanding, discretion, and I'm going to give you some wealth too." Okay? And so this is a thing we ask for. Okay, we lack wisdom, we ask of the Lord, and it says it shall be given him. Verse 6, "But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. For he that wavereth is like the wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed." Okay, now let him ask in faith. This is a famous charismatic statement, and this is how they usually blame the one with infirmities because they didn't get healed because he didn't have enough faith. Okay, let him ask in faith. What does that mean? Does that mean we have a positive attitude about it, that we're going to get the request? Or is it like the 3 Hebrew children when they were getting ready to be thrown into the fiery furnace. I like their response. Okay? They did not know if they were going to get fried or not. They didn't know. They knew that God could deliver them. You read it in Daniel 3. But they didn't know if he was going to deliver them. And then he came back and said, just let you be known, King, we are still not going to bow down. So now that's faith. Now our faith in prayer is that you know God can answer it, but you just may not know if he will answer it in the fashion you want or I want. Okay, and so that's what faith is. Okay, faith is believing what God says. We ask about anything, but you see, God can say no. God can say wait. Okay, but we know God can fulfill the prayer request anytime. So, verse 7, the second sentence of the verse. He that wavereth is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Okay, so from verse 6 to 8, he is likening man to water, specifically water on an ocean. The water on the ocean is a wave. Now, is it not funny? Is it not funny if you go to a professional game? It's not real popular anymore, but you remember a few years back where they would do the wave. I mean, first time I saw that in person, I just laughed and laughed. It's the funniest thing. But how many of those people know that they got that term from the Bible? I don't think they put it on the score, you know, the big sign out front. Let's do a Bible thing, the wave. No, people follow what the Bible sets a standard and we don't even realize it. The idea is that an unstable man is like water in that he seeks his own level. And that's why he's crooked. Okay, the negative aspect of water seeking his own level is a portrayal of a man. The positive aspect of water, the cleansing aspect of the water, is a picture of the Bible. Okay, and that's like I mentioned on his last Sunday, the Sunday before, about the words that we express are vibration. They have vibrations, they have energies that come from our mouth. And a doctor in Japan studied water, and he studied water on the spoken word, on the written word, okay, and then he studied water on music. And as this word, spoken word, was put in the presence of this water, he would freeze it and it would crystallize, and then he would look at the molecules. And from the words love or hate, it was a complete difference. Beautiful arranged crystals on the water for love. Okay, for hate, it was all distorted, deformed. For anger, distorted, deformed. And that's the spoken word and the written word. And Jan and I was driving behind a car coming up here, and it had a pyramid with an O, and I forget what word it had on the other one. It was a weird word also. And I thought, man, just think the vibes that those words give off. It's like when we throw a rock in the water, the ripple. Okay, so when we speak words to people, our body's made up of water, a lot of it. And that creates a ripple effect in our body. Okay? Well, we know the ripple effect fades away, but the more Bible words that's expressed around an individual, the more physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual ripple effects that will take place in that person. That's why we want to get around the Word of God. It's funny. The Bible is referred to as a health to our navel. Okay? This is one physical health aspect that people don't even discuss. The New Agers are too busy trying to help their body live longer, and they need to. They need to do that because it kind of delays hell a little bit later. Okay? But they don't even consider the aspect of the Bible. Now, if you look at Ruckman, listen to Ruckman, he was not a health nut. I mean, he liked his bacon, okay? But he had so much Bible, and there are a lot of health things that he did. He did hot and cold often. He'd run barefoot, okay? And that would be what's called earthing, okay? And what the biggest health thing that he did was so much Bible. And that was probably the biggest thing why he made it into the 90s. It certainly wasn't his diet. He exercised a lot. He ran barefoot a lot. And after on a hot day, he'd jump into freezing cold water. And there are some great benefits, health benefits of that. Those are some things I heard. But anything else? Eating? He and Roloff sitting across each other? No way, not for him. Okay, but you see, the Bible in Proverbs chapter 3 says it's health to our navel. And our navel is one way that health people do discover what your body needs by touching the navel. Okay, and so in verse 6, 7, and 8, in 8 particular, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Okay, a double-minded man, if we take this back to Genesis chapter 49, this is a comment or a prophecy that Jacob gave about his firstborn son. Genesis 49, verse 3. Okay, Reuben committed a horrible act. Okay, Genesis 49:3, and this is Jacob up in years. And he's prophesying is what he's doing. He's prophesying about each of his boys in the immediate future, but more so in the last days, because you'll see that at the end of verse 1. In verse 3, it says, Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water. Thou shalt not excel, because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, then defilest thou it. He went up to my couch. So that was a terrible act what he committed there. Okay, and so he is considered unstable as water, double-minded. Okay, Psalm 12. Now any Bible believer pretty well knows that Psalm 12 is a pretty well-known verse, especially in verse 6 and 7. This brings the thought to mind of why is it that some pastors or some of their beliefs are so shaky, they're up and down, they're unstable. And the reason why it is because Psalms 12 verse 1 says, Help, Lord, for the godly man ceaseth, for the faithful fail from among the children of men. They speak vanity, everyone with his neighbor, with flattering lips, and with a double heart do they speak. So he's talking about godly men, talking about them failing, talking about them having a double heart, talking about them speaking vanity, all within the context of the promise of the preservation of the words of God in verse 6 and 7. That's within that context. Okay, this is why final authority in any discussion you have with anybody, the bottom line issue, I don't care if it's Mormon, Catholic, Muslim, I don't care if it's JW or anything, bottom line authority, a bottom line issue is final authority. That's the bottom line. In any discussion, who or what has the final authority? Okay, in the realm, in the world of words, he who defines the word wins the argument. Okay, so who defines our words? Well, our final authority does. So if you have one final authority, then you can have a valid discussion. But if one party has two authorities, his opinion becomes his final authority. Because if you have two authorities, that when they conflict, who's going to decide which one's right? Well, it's going to be him. And this is why Alexandrian scholars get so upset with people who question their authority because you're questioning their godly opinion. It's personal. Okay, and so one of the years ago when I started studying King James issue, and I thought Ruckman was exaggerating the issue, so I started writing several schools, and I got some letters back from Maranatha Baptist Bible College. It wasn't Cederholm, it was Weiniger. It was after Cederholm died, it was Weiniger is the guy that took it over. And so we got four letters back and forth. And in the third letter, I think I asked him what his final authority was. Okay, and he said, my final authority is the Lad Metzger's and the Received Text. Okay, now those words don't mean a lot to people. But the Received Text is the name for the Greek manuscripts of the King James Bible. The Lad Metzger's is the name of the manuscript for the New Bibles. They're two separate texts or family of texts. So he had two final authorities, which placed him at the top. Okay, and after the fourth letter, he'd written and said something like, well, this correspondence is not going anywhere. We're not helping each other, so I think we're going to stop the correspondence. And my last letter was, this correspondence has helped me immensely. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. You have cemented me further into my beliefs. Okay, and so I appreciated it. Okay, and this is why preachers, their beliefs are up and down, is because they have multiple authorities. This is the same in the Catholic Church. You ask people of the Catholic hierarchy, where do you get your beliefs? What's your final authority? They'll say the Bible and tradition. So they have two authorities. What do you do when they conflict? Well, they say they don't. Of course they do. Who becomes the final authority? The priest or the pope. He determines which one's right. So they're following a man. Okay? The same with the Mormons. The Mormons have four or five authorities. They've got Book of Mormon, Bible, Doctrines and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price, and I can't remember the fifth. Oh, the prophets, the human prophets. So what do you do when they conflict? That's why they don't know what they really truly believe. Okay, and so this is why James 1 verse 8 is very practical, is that when a man has a double mind, he's unstable in all his ways. Okay, and this is why I noticed in the past, you know, students coming through Hiles Anderson becoming preachers, okay, where when their faith gets shook in the man of God, and they discover the man of God wasn't what he claimed to be, you don't know where they're going to land doctrinally because they got no final authority. I mean, I've seen some of them go charismatic route, some go to contemporary route, some go to Calvinist route. And then, you know, when I saw one of the guys I was in school with several years later, one of the first questions he asked me is, Dave, are you still married? I said, yeah, why would you ask that question? He said, well, you can't believe how many aren't. I said, well, yeah, I do believe it because I know it's true. Why? Multiple authorities. Okay, that's why we have one final authority. We put the Bible as a final authority. Okay, people say, you know, the Bible, what do you mean by that? Well, obviously you know what I mean. Okay, and a lot of times I don't like to tip my hand to people when I say the Bible is a final authority. I'm referring to one specific book. But I'm waiting for them to figure that out. Instead of me just come out and saying it, if I'm discussing with somebody, saying the King James Bible, their feather's going to, you know, they're going to come out. I just say the Bible, and if they're using something else, it's going to lead to that issue no matter what, and they're going to be the ones bringing it up. That way you get them thinking about it. Okay, us parents, we say to the kids, go to the car. Aren't we referring to a specific car out there? Okay, when we say pick up the ball, we're referring to a specific ball. If they pick up the wrong one, we're going to say, no, not that one. Okay, and when we say the Bible is the final authority for all matters of faith and practice, that statement is saying there is one book, present tense, that I can get in my hands, is the final authority. And if they don't believe that, they need to put that in their statement of faith. Okay, and so that's James 1:8. Then it says, let the brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted, but the rich in that he is made low, because as a flower of the grass he shall pass away. Okay, now the flower of the grass in our culture we know would be the dandelion. Okay, but here Gibbs starts the idea that anybody rich in this letter is in trouble, and anybody's poor is somebody that is right with God or has faith. Okay, and verse 11, for the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but it withereth the grass, and the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perisheth, so also shall the rich man fade away in his ways. Okay, so when a person reads that, okay, in our age, a person might overreact and say, well, then I got to get rid of everything. Well, here's the passage for folks that have some money in our age. 1 Timothy chapter 6. He says, charge them that are rich in this world. Okay, so here's the charge. That they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to feel guilty about. That's the liberal agenda. That's what they do every Thanksgiving day. During halftime, they show something about homeless people. So you and I feel guilty about stuffing our gut with turkey. Okay? No, I'm enjoying it. It's just I'm kind of tired after I eat the turkey, but I plan on that. Okay? So he tells us, enjoy it. It's a blessing of God that you can have an opportunity to help, for example, the Filipino pastor, where they're poor in this age. Okay? If God gives us some wealth, then we could pass it to them to help them out, and we're investing in eternity. And then he says that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. Why? These are temptations if somebody has, you know, a bigger bank account than somebody else. Laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. Okay, so that's the advice for wealth in the church age. And again, in our culture, you know, man, compared to the world, we're all wealthy. Okay, but still at that, if we go back to James and we recognize that the brother of low degree is told to rejoice because he's blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Okay, and it's not going to be soon after that. I mean, they're going to get it pretty quick. I mean, it is going to be soon after that. But the rich guy is told, okay, again, the reason why he's in trouble is because the only way to have the wealth in the tribulation time period is have the mark and the name and the number, or each of one of those. Okay, so he's troubled there. Now, he also portrays grass here, okay, grass. And the flower thereof, or the dandelion. If we go forward to 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 24, he portrays grass or mowing a lawn. Mowing the lawn is a picture of the second coming of Christ. Okay, so 1 Peter 1, verse 24, for all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man as the flower of grass. The grass withereth, and the flower thereof falleth away, but the word of the Lord endureth forever, and this is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. Okay, so the lawnmower, it's not like a combine, in that a combine is called a thresher. In the old days, they would harvest the corn on the ear, on the cob, put it in a bin-like structure that wasn't a grain bin, solid structure. It was a wired-type bin. And then as the wind naturally blew through this storage, then the moisture of the corn would naturally decrease. It would be like a natural dehydrator, okay, is what it's doing. Well, now, like on the farm, we got a great big grain dryer. So you can go ahead and pick the corn. You don't really want to pick it when it's, you know, real wet, because it kind of makes the cornmeal kind of makes it mushy. Okay, so it's got to have some moisture, usually around 28% or so, and you like it lower. Okay, so then you bring it to the farm and you put it in this grain dryer, and it's got heat going through there, and then you bring it down to 15%. Okay, when you bring it down to 14 or 15%, you can put it in a grain bin, okay, and that will preserve. Okay, in the wintertime, you want to run the grain fan so you get cool air in there, cool it down, and then it will pretty much preserve through the wintertime. Okay, if it's any hotter than that, then it will begin to mold. So he's portraying the combine as a threshing machine. It threshes. So that's a portrayal of the second coming of Christ, where you have in the front, if soybeans, a sickle bar, where it cuts the soybean off about half inch or 1 inch off the ground. You want to get as low as possible to get the pods. If it's a corn head, it will grab the stalk and yank the stalk down, the ear pops off. It goes into the front part of the combine, into a place called the beater house, okay, where it separates the seed from all the chaff. Then it goes through the combine. In the back, it have a wind that kind of makes the chaff float as it goes through a straw walker, and then the chaff blows out the back. The ungodly are like the chaff, which a wind driveth away. And then the seed goes through this sieve and goes up into the grain tank. The seed is a picture of the rapture, okay, or the believer going up into heaven. In the lawnmower, what you're doing is you're just shooting the grass out unless you're collecting it. Okay, that's a picture of a threshing machine of cutting men. And he's just throwing it out there. If you would look at Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 12. Habakkuk, cup of coffee. I guess that's how you pronounce that. Habakkuk, cup of coffee. Habakkuk chapter 3. When you find it, raise your hand. Oh, Ainge already had it. She wins. Habakkuk chapter 3, much of this chapter, if not all of it, is about the second coming of Christ. And in verse 12 it says, "Thou didst march through the land in indignation. Thou didst thresh the heathen in anger." There's our thresher machine, combine, lawnmower. Okay, so when you got a lawnmower and you're spewing the grass out, and you say, "Man, there's the Pope and company." You know, going out there. Okay, all wicked people, all sinners going out there. Okay, and that's what the second coming's like. Okay, men are like grass, and the lawnmower is the second coming. Okay, and that's how the Lord's portraying these things. So he takes these everyday pictures that we see, and he's portraying the most important doctrine of the Bible, is the second coming of Christ. Okay, that's James, up to verse 11, 12, kind of another idea, so we'll stop there. Any questions or comments?